Your trend on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Thank you, Steve. 137. Live in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. It's John Williams. How are you? By the way, I'm not really in the studio. I've been digitally put here with the Photoshop app. No, I'm kidding. I'm in the Showcase Studio. It's good to be in Chicago and on Michigan Avenue. We're here until 3 o'clock. We talk Trump talk at 2 o'clock, and so that'll be Sally Yates and the Devin Nunes controversy, which continues. It appears as though that investigation on the House side is stalling because they can't figure out if Nunes should lead it. We'll talk to a Washington Post senior political reporter, Aaron Blake, again, just to catch you and me up on where we are on that after 2. And then something new Facebook is doing that makes it easier to follow your favorite politicians. We'll explain in the next hour. So the headline's fascinating. Vintage U.S. nuclear test films declassified and publicized. There's a website you go to, and it's put up by the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. That's LLNL, Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. If you just Google that and then to also put in the word playlist, it'll take you. The first option is a YouTube channel of these old nuclear test videos. The first one is Operation Hardtack 1, Nutmeg 51538. I have no idea what that means. I'm about to find out. But this is unbelievable what you see. The power and the visual, it's just amazing. I mean, it's sort of like a Far Side cartoon, the mushroom cloud that comes up and how quickly it does. Greg Spriggs is a nuclear weapon physicist at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. And he said he'd explain a little of this to us. Hi, Greg. It's John Williams. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you doing today?
Pretty good. How did this project get started? Did you all along know of these thousands of archived videos, or did you all only recently stumble upon them?
Well, we knew that the videos existed in the archives over at Los Alamos, and there were some videos here in our archives at Livermore. And they had been sitting in the vault for 50 or 60 years, and we knew that they were decomposing. And so we thought we would try to preserve the data that was on these particular films. And so we started this project in order to do that.
So really, that's funny. I mean, this was deteriorating on film. They hadn't already digitally archived it all?
No, film scanning industry actually took off about 20 years ago when Hollywood was trying to preserve a lot of their Hollywood films and digitize everything. And so it became sort of a niche industry. And back in the 60s and 70s, there was no way to really digitize it until just recently. And so we bought a scanner and started digitizing them.
It's amazing to me. I mean, you think, hey, if we're going to blow up a nuclear weapon and take a movie of it to see what happens, you'd find a way to preserve the film, you know?
Yeah, in the old days, they used to do film-to-film transfer, and that's how they preserved it. But yeah. Anytime you do a film-to-film transfer, you end up destroying some of the original data. It doesn't make an exact copy, and that was the problem with it, is you got a nice visual image, but the data was altered.
Oh, any of us that made cassette-to-cassette or any kind of audio-to-audio transfer back in the day know the second generation's always a little hissier. It's not the quality's not there. So what's the quality, then, of the stuff that you've got?
We scan the original film, and we match the optical density on the film. That is, we measure on the negative the darkness of it, and our scanner is calibrated such that we match point by point the optical density all the way across the frame.
How many videos, then, do we have?
Well, we thought that EG&G might have filmed as many as 10,000 of them, and there, we've been able to locate about 6,500 so far, and we think the other ones are probably sitting in the National Archives or in a museum that was established by EG&G, which was the company that actually did the videos.
6,500, but that's not 6,500 separate blasts, is it?
No, they usually had about 50 cameras on every detonation, just in case one of the cameras failed or several of the cameras failed. So there were 210 atmospheric tests with about 50 cameras on each shot, so around 10,000 films total.
And then it looked like there were some also that were in the water.
They were out in the Pacific or on the island of Bikini or Eniwetok. This was called the Pacific Proving Grounds, and this is where we initially started the nuclear testing. It was far enough away from civilization that nobody was going to get hurt. So that's, yeah, the one that you're seeing nutmeg there was the Pacific shot.
So if we have a couple hundred of these then, did that just completely irradiate the land? I mean, I would imagine it killed all the fish nearby, and what about the fallout? What would happen in, with respect to all of that?
Yeah, most of these were above ground. They would build a tower maybe 300, 400 feet above the surface and try to keep the fireball off of the ground so that there was very, very little fallout that occurred from it. Most of it became global fallout, and of course we're still seeing that today where the natural radiation background has gone up. But in terms of killing fish, yeah, if the fish were in that local area, it probably did kill some of them. But for the most part, the shots were high enough off the surface that there was very little impact on the environment.
And it didn't harm mankind or the planet in any way then, huh?
It did leave global fallout, and that's why they finally banned atmospheric testing. We were seeing this global fallout, which was the residual radiation from these nuclear detonations, the fission products that eventually settled onto the Earth's surface. So, yeah, that's why we stopped doing it. It was not a good thing.
What do the movies look like?
Well, you're seeing them on that website there. Yeah. These are scientific films. We are dedicated right now to just doing the scientific films because as a scientist, I'm trying to get the data off of it. There was another organization called Lookout Mountain that did documentary filming. They filmed about 20,000 films. The ones on the YouTube website for Livermore are the scientific ones showing the fireball, the early cloud, and the late cloud.
And so, again, if you want to see this, and I think Elif has put it up. Did I send that to you, Elif? If you go to LLNL and then leave a space, this is just a Google search, but that's Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, and then playlist, there's the YouTube channel of the videos that they have up there now. And the first one's a home run. I got to tell you, Greg, if I was going to lead with one, that thing is classic. It's this, you know, intense light. And then all of a sudden the light subsides, so now you can see a little bit more. And then, boom, up goes the blast. And then a cloud, like a gigantic ring. And then another ring on top of that, but a little smaller. And then inside, sort of a brown and orange, what looks like smaller area of smoke, like maybe where the blast was. But it's spooky. It's utterly spooky to look at.
Yeah, that's correct. What happens is out in the Pacific, there was a lot of humidity in the air. And so it initially, the shock wave coming off of the blast goes out in its very high pressure region. But behind the shock wave is a low pressure region, and the moisture condenses, and that creates what's called a Wilson cloud. And then the Wilson cloud, as the pressure comes back up to atmospheric pressure, the Wilson cloud disappears, and you can see where the initial blast was. And that's the mushroom cloud that's left behind, that after the cloud disappears, that white one, then you're seeing the actual mushroom cloud.
What do they learn from watching these movies? You know, even then, was it visually instructive for them in some way, or was it more Geiger counters and some other sort of meters?
Yeah, they usually had about 100 different experiments going on any particular detonation where they were measuring different things, the shockwave overpressure, the velocity, the nuclear fallout that came from it. But the primary thing for the film, the primary reason for it, was to try to capture the shock wave as a function of time. And by using some mathematical equations that were derived back in 1941, you can figure out how much energy was released by watching where that shock wave was at each particular point in time. So that was their primary way of figuring out the yield of the device.
Well, that seems rudimentary, but I guess that's the way it was back then. But how can you don't see the shock wave, do you, or do you?
Initially, you do. Now, this particular film of Nutmeg was an early cloud film. There are other versions of other films for this particular shot that recorded maybe the first half a second or so before the Wilson cloud was formed. And from that, you can actually see the shock wave. The film was running usually at around 2,400 frames per second. The shock wave moves at Mach 200. That is, it's moving at 200 times the speed of sound. And at that speed, if the shock wave would reach from San Francisco to New York in about a minute. But luckily, it's a spherical shock wave, and so it dissipates very quickly, and it degenerates to an acoustic wave. So from that shock wave, that early photography, we measure where the shock wave is as a function of time, and from that, we can figure out the yield.
Number five on this, Operation Dominic and Operation Plum Debob, Diablo and Houstonic. That one looks like just like this giant gaseous explosion, orange balls of flame, sort of enveloping each other as it gets wider still. Again, just utterly sinister and powerful. I guess you're a scientist and you've worked in this field so long. Maybe you don't have the visceral reaction I've been having to watching these, but comment a little bit on that. Yeah.
The one on Housatonic, that was a big yield device. That was probably on over about 8 megatons. That fireball is huge. It's about 2 miles across, and it was filmed from an airplane. And every time I see it, I'm in awe of how big that fireball is. That's a huge fireball.
Yeah.
And what you're seeing are basically the hot gases left behind from the explosion. And that bubble that you see in the atmosphere is a very low-density region, and it glows for several minutes. If you were to sit here and watch this film out 2 or 3 minutes, it would glow for several minutes before it cools off.
Imagine somebody, a city, a village, some people being underneath that. I guess that's what they're doing, though, trying to see what the destruction capacity is of these things.
Yeah, we were trying to measure the nuclear weapon effect from it, so they had all sorts of instruments to measure how far out the shockwave went, what the overpressure was, and what kind of damage it would do to structures and to people and so forth.
Mm. Yeah, it's really amazing. I sound like, wow, cool, but also, wow, not cool, but it is what it is. And this is our archive. It should be made public. People should be able to see. If the United States and Russia are going to get back into an arms race, I think it would behoove all of us to just look for a second at the destructive force of these things and then move on accordingly. And there it is. It's Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory is archiving these. If you remember that, it's easy to remember the easiest search, LLNL, and then leave a space and then type in the word in your Google search playlist. Or just go to my Facebook page. We've put the link to it there. Hey, good luck to you guys, Greg. Appreciate your time, thoughts, and expertise on this.
Thank you very much for the interest.
Yeah, I got some. Maybe you do, too. It's on my Facebook page. I'm King John on Facebook. It's 1:49. Here's how all across the board we are on this show. I mean, there's that conversation. Yesterday, we spent a lot of time talking about, is it wrong for girls to wear leggings on airplanes? Boy, you missed a dandy of a show yesterday. Let me tell you, Steve Bertrand. I lit up the phones with that bad boy.
Well, and did you get to the resolution about the Friends Fly Free sort of thing?
Well, sure. So I think the story isn't nearly as, exciting as it sounds. It's reasonable that the airline has a different standard, and you got to play by the rules.
Sharon, my wife, pointed out to me that she and friends flew overseas on one of these plans,
Oh, really?
Yeah. They were a friend of an employee, so they got a great discount. And one of the people in their group, this was 15 years ago, had to change their shoes.
Are you kidding?
In order to fly on the flight because it didn't meet their requirements.
I was on one of those cruises that you and Nancy Kelly and travel people set us up on. And so there I am, John Williams with a group. I thought I was a VIP. I find myself in one of the lounges, and a guy came up to me and said, "Sir, you don't have a jacket on. You're going to have to leave." And I went, "Oh, of course, I know that. Shame on me." And I walked out and went to where the regular people were instead.
Where you felt more at home.
Far be it from me to climb up the social ladder. But it does remind me of a conversation I had not that long ago when I tried to order an airplane ticket, and they talked to me about this phenomenon. I'll play that back for you next on WGN.
Weekdays, WGN Radio.